And I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN, our last edition of 2012. Merry Christmas. Hope you had a good holiday. And our weekly mission is to keep South Florida informed on local and regional news and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area's top journalists. This week, there are two of our own. We bring to you our editor for Arts and Enterprise, Alicia Zuckerman, who's been a producer on this show for many years, since its beginning 3 years ago. Welcome to the panel, Alicia.
Thanks, Phil. Happy to be here.
John Yearwood is no stranger to these microphones. He is the world editor for the Miami Herald. He has guided the paper's coverage on international events this year, and we'll talk a lot about that and some other things local and regional with John. And we welcome you back, John.
Pleasure to be here, Phil.
And Kenny Malone is our feature reporter. He's been all over the map this year, covering the state of Florida, South Florida, elections, just about everything else. And he's also with us on our panel this week as we remember 2012. Hi, Kenny. Welcome
hey,
back.
Phil.
So we are remembering 2012 during this show, and we're going to talk about looking ahead to 2013. We asked you by Twitter and by Public Insight Network what your top stories were for 2012, and we asked you, and we'll hear some of those thoughts as we go on. But we'll start with the election panel. It's over, but again, Florida was the state that could not vote straight. Long lines for early voting, and on election night in Miami-Dade, left voters frustrated. Florida left blank on the electoral map for days as absentee ballots were tallied in a total of 9 counties, all 3 here in South Florida, the big counties. Can the state shake off the latest electoral dysfunction? Who takes the blame? And how will it get fixed once and for all? Now, even without Florida's results, President Obama won re-election, and Florida becomes a bluer shade of purple with Democrats making gains at the state and national level.
They're tired of the division. They want unity.
We may be from different parties, but they have my respect, and we want to see our community and our families prosper.
I'm going to work with any person, anybody, who wants to move this country forward.
Now, I think the voters were focused on issues that are impacting them day after day, jobs and the economy and bringing fiscal responsibility back to Washington. But when you're running in a presidential year, there are a lot of factors that are outside of your control.
First of all, admit you have a problem. And then secondly, let's try to fashion our message in a way that doesn't disenfranchise complete communities.
Now, that was a sampling of some of the voices that we heard on election night, first with victorious Democrats Bill Nelson, Joe Garcia, and Lois Frankel, then defeated Republican David Rivera. And finally, Ileana Ross-Layton, a reelected Republican who feels her party must change after more than 70% of Hispanics voted for President Obama this time around. John, from a world perspective, first seeing the region, and then what was it like here in Florida election time 2012?
Well, Phil, one of the interesting things I remember tweeting about that, and the fact that I've seen and attended elections all over the world, whether it's in South Africa or part of the Americas, and they're often long lines. It takes a while sometimes for people to vote, but that's because the lines are long because a huge number of people would like to vote, and there was not any effort, it seems, to prevent people from voting. But it seems clear from what I heard from a number of people here in Florida that what happened here was fairly transparent. It seems that more of an effort to prevent people from voting than to allow people to vote. And as a result, we had, what some people call the mess that we had.
And we're going to talk about that mess in just a moment. But, you know, you come from Trinidad, your international perspective on things, but you know in other countries that people do not take the right to vote for granted, that it is something that's almost mandatory. In some countries, it's actually against the law if you don't vote. So around the world, how did people see this, especially what happened here in Florida?
Well, clearly, in a number of places, Florida was the laughingstock of the world. And a lot of people were saying, well, that's not unusual because it's happened before. We were laughing at Florida the last time. In fact, a number of places people were saying, you know, why are they allowing Florida to vote? So that's a question. But you're absolutely right. In many parts of the Americas, people vote on Sunday. because they want to have the maximum participation. And in many places, when it comes to a presidential election, we're seeing upwards of 80-90% of the population of the, those able to vote voting, because it's they see it as a very important part of their commitment to their countries and democracy.
And Kenny, you went around the state of Florida, a 2,000-mile journey, which also included two speeding tickets, I understand, with Herald photographer Patrick Farrell, and you tried to find the average voter in Florida, the folks that really would possibly decide, turns out did not, the 2012 election, and your reflections in your swing state project. What did you find? Did you find it to be as moderate as it seems in the election that bore out?
Yeah, it was. This trip was called Dispatches from the Swing State, and it was essentially an experiment to find people that we were interested in talking to first, and then eventually we would let the politics come into the conversation. So we weren't seeking out red voters or blue voters or purple voters. We just found people who were doing interesting things, and then we would chat with them. And inevitably, the people we talked to were far more balanced than I think people expect from the state, and not just specific parts, the entire state. I mean, we were in Ocala, we were in the Panhandle, in Panacea, Florida, we were all the way down in Key West, and all across the board, people were weighing things. On one hand, this; on the other hand, that, and then they would come down somewhere in the election. But they saw it from both perspectives, and a purple state, for sure. And
Alicia, you helped to lead our coverage for the election. What do you think of
that's right? Well, I wanted to ask Kenny. You know, there's this adage in Florida: the further north you go, the further south you get.
Right.
I mean, it sounds like you found that that's actually not really the case.
I mean, culturally, it is sort of the case, right? So as we went farther north, we came across issues that you would associate more with Southern culture. People were a little more worried about gun control, and they were a little more worried about the healthcare issues, feeling like their rights were being infringed upon. But generally speaking, those were small things. They were not one issue voters, and we probably found more Republicans as we went north. But more Democrats than I think we expected.
Despite the president's reelection, state leaders still balking at the health care law. And John, from an international perspective, you also know that this is health care is mandatory in many other countries, too. But here, still trying to get used to that idea and wrap around that idea here in Florida, where there's still opposition to this.
Well, yeah, because actually in the last several months, I've been both to Canada and to London, where folks are, you know, take this issue very seriously, where, you know, healthcare for the most part is free. I mean, they don't have the absolute best healthcare, but certainly if something happens to someone, they know they can go to a hospital and get treatment with little to no cost. I think one of the things that people are talking about here is whether or not Florida wants to, you know, again stand out from the rest of the nation by not being a part of this law. The Supreme Court has ruled, and it's the law of the land. And I think that's one of the reasons why you're probably seeing some movement on the part of some legislators here to be more part of it than to be away from it. So that's, I guess, for a number of people here, that's a good thing, especially in a state where we have some of the poorest people in the land.
Yeah. Alicia, you want to put a capper on it?
Well, I think there's sometimes a tendency in the state of Florida to look at itself as a kind of rogue state in a way, to sort of think of itself as outside of the rest of the country, to hold fast to its independence, and whether that's the southern half of Florida or the northern half, which I think sometimes you can almost think of as two different cultures altogether, or maybe more than two different cultures altogether. And this reaction to healthcare reform seems to be sort of part and parcel of that.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Our panel today on our year-end show, Alicia Zuckerman, our editor here at WLRN Miami Herald News, along with Kenny Malone, feature reporter, and John Yearwood, who is the world editor for the Miami Herald. I'm Phil Latzman. We'll take some of your responses from the Public Insight Network. We are recorded today for the holidays, so no phone calls, please. But thanks for all of your feedback, and you can always be a fan of ours on Facebook, like our page at the Florida Roundup on Facebook, and also follow follow us on Twitter at WLRN. We usually read those tweets. So back to the problems with the election here in Florida, which has sort of taken up the most of the conversation since Election Day. The mass amount of voting trouble the state, the region had again this year after early voting saw long, long lines. Things got even worse on election night, and especially in Miami-Dade County.
They had so much time to get it together, and then you get this.
Everybody that was with me in that line, all of them stayed here until the end.
Extend early voting hours, all right? Allow us to use in early voting different sites to have those early voting sites, because right now we have to go either into a library or into a city hall or county hall by law.
Whenever you finish a project, in this case an election, let's go back and look. What went right? What can we improve? Constantly look at how can we improve things for you, the citizens of the state.
Whether you voted for the very first time or waited in line for a very long time. By the way, we have to fix that.
For once, Florida's cluster is irrelevant. It's like hearing good news, America. The tumor on your dong is benign.
Either. It still gets laughs even 2 months later. In order, we heard from Miami-Dade voters Michelle Hernandez and Jacob DeVries. They were not laughing as they were frustrated and tired after waiting 6 hours to vote in Kendall on election night. Then Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez, Florida's Governor Rick Scott, President Obama, and finally Jon Stewart from The Daily Show delivering the punchline. Perhaps Florida's election trouble telling us again how we vote in this state. And we'll start this off with some reflections from our members of the Public Insight Network of what they thought the most important story of 2012 was. Paul from Hollywood says, because South Florida has become the laughingstock of the nation because when it comes to handling elections correctly, no one has faith in the voting system. And then Raquel in Miami on the mishaps of the 2012 election says, quote, we'll either make it better next time or there'll be new sophisticated ways to suppress the vote. And then Patrick from West Park says, thinks that the election demonstrates something larger about Florida. Quote, Florida's irrelevance in the election is the most significant because it shows the rest of the country what the rest of the country thinks, but we've not realized all the other stories, the shooting of Trayvon Martin, the Causeway Cannibal, and the collapse of the Miami-Dade College Garage are connected into their results of a bygone era that Florida still exists in. Had the other events happened in any other state, they would have been resolved swiftly. So, Alicia, you're raising your hand here. Both you and John, you want to start it off?
Well, Phil, we had a lot of discussions in the newsroom ahead of the election coverage and during the election coverage and the run-up to the election, talking about the importance of Florida in this election. And we spent so much time thinking of ourselves as such an important swing state, maybe the swing state. We said that a couple of times. And then it turns out that people are waiting in line to vote for 6 hours and hearing that President Obama has been elected, reelected, and they're still waiting to vote. And so we really descended into true irrelevance that night. It's not to say, obviously, that votes don't count in the big picture, of course, but I think, what does that feel like to be standing in line waiting to vote and to hear that the election has been called?
John?
Well, I cannot tell you what it exactly feels like, but I can tell you what it feels like to be standing in line for 4 hours to vote at a time when you sort of look at the polling place in my small town, and I thought that I can get in and maybe it'll take me an hour and a half, but 4 hours later I was still standing in line getting ready to cast a vote. He did it because, one, you'd stood, in my case, I'd stood in line for a long time, but two, it was important that I voted. But then you look at the reasons why I had to stand in line for 4 hours, and you look at the processes in the polling station, and it was a lot of things that they were doing just didn't make any sense, and I couldn't figure out why someone had not identified some of these problems sooner, and I guess as I mentioned earlier, in some cases people probably didn't want to identify what the problems were because the end result that people stood in line for a long time perhaps is what a number of people wanted.
And yeah, now we have the pointing fingers now, but go ahead, Alicia.
I had a lot of the same questions. I mean, where was the foresight in this? Florida is a state that obviously has something to prove when it comes to the process of voting. And so I just wondered, in the decisions to reduce the number of early voting days and some of the other decisions that were made, such as decisions made about keeping the precincts the same as opposed to adjusting them with the varying districts, you know, where was the foresight? How come nobody saw this coming?
By the way, Kenny, you were covering the campaign of Joe Garcia that night, and what could be the top political story locally was the defeat of David Rivera, Congressman. In fact, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk about that. But you were directly involved sort of in that coverage that night of kind of hearing reports of these people waiting online during that election.
Yeah, there was some thought that we wouldn't be able to call the Rivera-Garcia race for a while because major chunks of South Dade County were still standing in line. And I will say this, the one major takeaway I got from long lines at the poll is that if someone hands out donuts and coffee, no one cares. That's like the only thing that kept coming up in the long lines. Oh, I didn't care. There was donuts and coffee in my line.
So there's a way to solve the problem right there.
More investment.
Perfect. Donuts and coffee. And you don't mind waiting.
And when I used to vote in New York, there were always bake sales, but I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. I remember that. Yeah. All right, you're listening to the Florida Roundup. That's Alicia Zuckerman, Kenny Malone, John Yearwood. I'm Phil Latzman. We'll come back. We'll talk about the top local political story and then the top story period of the year that at least we've come to talk about, the Trayvon Martin case. Stay with us. We're back in just a moment. And welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Our guests for our year-end program, Kenny Malone and Alicia Zuckerman from our WLRN Miami Herald news outfit, and John Yearwood, who is world editor for the Miami Herald. We'll talk about the world and international issues and how they affected us here in South Florida a little bit later on in the program. We are pre-recorded today, though, but if you'd like to share your top stories, certainly tweet us at WLRN, or you can post your recommendations on our Facebook page, which is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'd say that the biggest story of the year locally was the David Rivera story, politically biggest story of the year. His downfall, another story, and also the loss of the Republican Congressman Alan West, who's one of the more outspoken Tea Party members, came in 2 years ago. But Rivera, the former state legislator, had been hounded by ethics, civic, and criminal investigations for years. They did not hurt his popularity until around election time, and first there was evidence that he may have helped fund the campaign of a Democratic candidate named Justin Lamar Sternad, who was running against Rivera's main Democratic challenger, Joe Garcia. Then after the early voting had started, right in the week before the election, the State Ethics Commission found that Rivera, as a state legislator, had committed 11 ethics violations for, among other things, working under a secret deal as political consultant for Magic City Casino and by failing to disclose his finances. His loss ushered into the House the first Cuban-American Democrat from Florida, Joe Garcia. And David Rivera has been, in my years of covering Florida politics, there's all kinds of stories about David Rivera. The first one I remember was he actually ran a campaign bus or a campaign bus that was carrying the flyers of his opponent. He ran that off the road to prevent it being delivered to where it was supposed to go. So this is sort of, you know, the culmination of a lot of things. And it was a new district where he was running for. But I guess you can get away with things for a certain amount of time. And then, and as we see all over the world, John, it's going to catch up to you.
Absolutely. And if you follow the reporting of the Miami Herald, what he may or may not have done might not be that far different from what you described.
right, exactly.
The thing that I never understood about the allegation against Rivera, in particular, the allegation that he had been running a campaign, a dummy campaign against in the Democratic primary against who would become his opponent. There's a presumption that he's scared to run against somebody. He's scared that his campaign won't be good enough, but confident that he can run a dummy campaign well enough to railroad another campaign or to ruin another campaign. It's a confusing assumption on both fronts.
Well, it's just a political animal. I mean, he's a guy that knows this is the way he plays the game.
Right.
He doesn't know any other way to play the game, and you know it kind of caught up to him. Obviously, you know, people saw through that. Let's move on to, and we've talked about, it's really hard to put a finger on the top story period of the year in the state, but I think that it may not have had anything to do with politics at all, but it does have political implications. We're all involved in the situation with back in February. We'll turn the clock back then, beginning with a pair of 911 calls that came from the Orlando suburb of Sanford.
And he's a black male.
Okay. How old would you say he looked?
He's got a button on his shirt. Late teens.
Late teens, okay.
Mm-hmm. Something's wrong with him. Yeah. He's coming to check me out.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right, what is your number?
Gunshots.
You just heard gunshots?
Yes.
Today we filed an information charging George Zimmerman with murder in the second degree. A capias has been issued for his arrest.
I still get chills when you hear that. The two 911 calls that we heard there back to back. We heard shooter George Zimmerman, then the 911 call a few minutes later, documenting what turned out to be the death of Miami Gardens teen Trayvon Martin. And then many weeks later, a special prosecutor, Angela Corey, announcing finally the charges. And then, of course, the discussions about the Stand Your Ground law. John, how have we changed because of what happened in Sanford to this teenager from Miami Gardens?
Well, I think we are far more conscious of, what we do when it comes to, seeing people in some cases who don't look like us, and how we feel and how we approach other people. I think some of the discussion, even though one you would think that it sort of tore various communities apart, but in some cases it brought a lot of us closer together. And I know perhaps we'll be seeing a trial coming up in this case into the new year, so we'll see how it really tests what we've been able to do and what we've been able to learn from what happened almost a year ago.
Alicia, in the news, having to cover this and having to look at it, it just became bigger and bigger and bigger, and obviously it was something that was that everybody was paying attention to, and again, for all the wrong reasons, Florida is sort of in the spotlight in this. But the one thing that we were talking about and continue to talk about in the wake of this Newtown tragedy in Connecticut is gun control and the Stand Your Ground law here in Florida, which enables folks to use their guns in cases where they feel like they are threatened. Do you think that we might see some changes in that, or do you think how much do you think that that entered the national discussion in 2012?
I was surprised that it didn't enter the national discussion, and it didn't enter the discussion in Florida in particular more specifically a discussion about gun control. Now Zimmerman seems to have had his gun legally. He did have his gun legally. But nevertheless, I think when something like this happens, and again, last month, I think it was, or maybe even earlier this month, that middle school girl was shot and killed on her school bus. When these kinds of things happen, I always expect to hear a more robust discussion about guns and gun control and guns in our society. And of course, now we're hearing it. But you and I, Phil, in particular, had been having this discussion before the tragedy in Newtown. And I wonder, what does it take to get to the point where actual change is made? I mean, even in the aftermath of what just happened in Connecticut, Governor Scott wouldn't say with any specificity exactly what he would propose to do to make changes as far as guns are concerned in society. And, some people maybe think there don't need to be changes, but when you see one incident after another on both small and large scales, it really makes you question the role of guns in society.
Fort Lauderdale State Senator Chris Smith is one of the Democrats in the state legislature. It's filed a bill to try and amend the Stand Your Ground law. And there was actually a state panel that was convened. Governor Scott convened the state panel, which concluded that really no changes needed to be made in the Stand Your Ground law.
I think one of the questions that we're gonna find an answer to in the coming session here is that in the wake of the shooting in Connecticut, how much of the conversation has changed towards gun control? And a lot of the conversation in that case is also about mental health care and those kinds of things. But with the Trayvon Martin case, that discussion was primarily about the Stand Your Ground law. And I don't know if during session the incident in Connecticut is going to change that change that discussion and maybe undermine the critical mass that seemed to be forming against the Stand Your Ground law.
Yeah. John,
you know, and like the whether you like the Stand Your Ground law or not, if many people were arguing at the time, if you look at the composition of the panel that the governor put together, the end result was preordained. We sort of got
they
a sense
the
of where
they were the people that authored the law in the first place. Yeah.
We got a sense of what was going to happen well before the final decision, the final report was written and presented.
And I don't want to downplay the issue of race relations in all of this either. John, you said at the beginning of this discussion that you think that there was a greater sense of solidarity. You know, there was the Million Hoodie or the attempt to have the Million Hoodie March. There were young people wearing hoodies all over the place. And thinking about how, you know, people see a young black man wearing a hooded sweatshirt and, you know, that makes them feel nervous. Well, do you think there's any lasting effect of those conversations that came after that? I mean, do you think that that's going to continue and maybe make race relations easier than they are currently?
No, I don't think so. I think it was just a one-time blip. I mean, we've seen this happen many, many times in the past for different things that have come up. You see people get together. And what I was thinking about when I made that comment earlier, I was thinking about the major protest that we had seen, not just in Miami or Stamford or in parts of the United States. We've seen protests all around the world. And if you look at the composition of the people at these protests, not everyone was of the same color. So there was a lot of solidarity with trying at least to find justice, wherever that might be, coming out of what happened in Stamford. So, and it was an opportunity for a lot of people to rally around the same cause. And so that's what I was thinking about as I looked at the fact that it brought a lot of people together. But in terms of any lingering feelings about what happened, we've seen it happen in the past, and I don't think there's going to be much. It'd be interesting to see what happens once the trial starts and how people react to that.
I'll tell you one thing. At my son's middle school, I was there talking to some of the kids when this was, in a few weeks after this all happened. And, the African-American students were very, very, very tuned in to what was going on there. It raised their awareness. It made them read the newspaper. It made them, who knows, listen to WLRN. But, I mean, it really raised awareness among kids, not only black kids, but white kids, everybody, all the kids that were in that situation, teenagers and otherwise, sort of started waking up and going, wow, that's a story that I can really relate to. That's something that I can see.
And you couldn't avoid the story. It was everywhere. I know I had Representative Frederica Wilson on my World Desk program shortly after it happened and trying to explain what happened, how she was involved. In fact, as she pointed out, Trayvon Martin and his parents are part of her constituents. And some of the things that she said were pretty much out there, which, got people, writing letters and sending her some not so nice comments. But at least she was among many who were talking about the issue and raising the issue in such a way that you really had to pay attention.
Right, you're listening to the Florida Roundup, and we're going to continue getting some of your thoughts on the top stories of the year, locally and regionally and statewide. Kenny, though, you've traveled quite a bit this year, and in fact, you were part of state integrity investigation. Tell us a little bit about that and some of the thoughts you gathered doing that investigation.
Sure. The state integrity investigation was a collaboration between the Center for Public Integrity, a group called Global Integrity, Public Radio International, and then a number of member stations throughout the country. And basically, this was the first attempt to take a look across every single state at every single state government and assess the corruption risk is ultimately what the measure was. How susceptible to corruption is the government as it is currently set up? Every state was given a grade, and Florida actually did not do that badly. It was given a C-, which is like sort of middle of the pack. It's not great. It's not really bad. But you can break out little individual indicators, and one of the places where Florida was really, really bad, one of the worst in the country, was the gap between the laws that are on the books for campaign finances and for lobbyist restrictions and what can happen in actuality. We did a piece about this, and we've got a short snippet here, so go ahead and play that.
Florida has one of the strictest rules in the country for lobbyist gift giving, an absolute blanket ban. It also has one of the toughest laws for campaign contributions, a $500 limit. And yet there is a contradiction that everyone in Tallahassee seems to know about.
Here's the biggest one. A lobbyist cannot buy me dinner.
No gifts, no anything.
You can't even take a bottle of water.
Not a cup of coffee for our local legislators.
As a legislator, you can't even buy me a cup of coffee.
Cup of coffee.
Cup of coffee.
Cup of coffee. But I can sit across the table from them and slide across a $20,000
check. $25,000
check.
$50,000 check.
$100,000 from somebody for what we call a CCE.
So no coffee, but checks.
Giant checks. The way it works, basically, there are what are called soft money accounts. The prime example is what's called a committee of continuous existence. These are tied to legislators, and they can use them for things like travel. What else? There's a whole list of things that are okay, but it's not really campaign money. But what you can do is you can roll that money over into an ECO, electioneering communications organization, and that's what lets you kind of run attack ads that aren't really attack ads. You can't tell people to go vote, but you can tell them about the issues, and you can tell them about
your local senator.
Yeah, and you can tell them about why this guy running against you is not good on this issue. So it's a system that's sort of just full of holes. Somebody I think called it a Swiss cheese system in the campaign finance, and it's totally true. That's one of the major problems here.
You can find that investigation online, right? It was a Florida Center for Investigative Reporting.
This is the Center for Public Integrity.
CPI. Center for Public Integrity. Right.
But if you search for state integrity investigation, you can see the data, and you can also see what other coverage was done across the states. And Florida has its own website, and you can see a bunch.
We're going to come back and talk about the top international story and stories of the year here in South Florida. John Earwood, the world editor for the Miami Herald, will do that for us. I'm Phil Latzman with Kenny Malone and Alicia Zuckerman, back for our year-end roundup in just a moment. And I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. We're talking about how 2012 will be remembered. You can tell us what your top stories of the year are by tweeting us at WLRN or posting your recommendation on our Facebook page, the Florida Roundup on WLRN. We are on tape today, so we're not taking any calls live. We'll be back next week live for our show in the first week of January. Now, we all made predictions a year ago, or 2 years ago, I think. Alicia might remember this on the show. I think it was our first year. We all said at our year-end show, let's make some predictions for the following year. And I, off the cuff, said sea level rise, just because I'd been covering it. And
was that 2 years? I think it was 1 year ago.
It was either 1 or 2 years ago. I don't think I called it for this year. And not that it was the story of the year, but it's one of those incremental stories of our time. But here's Nelson from Water Hill, is a member of the Public Insight Network. We asked them this week, our informed army, about the most important news of the year this year, and he says the South Florida Summit message: climate change is here because South Florida has realized it must move aggressively to prepare for the worst and have a leadership role in attempting to prevent the worst case scenario predicted by a 4-degree rise in ocean temperatures. Of course, Miami Beach, the first city to take into account rising sea levels and planning an overhaul of its stormwater system. We saw the beach overrun in Fort Lauderdale, A1A disappearing. We see beaches disappearing everywhere, water coming up from drains, especially in high tide season. And we haven't even talked about Hurricane Superstorm, whatever you want to call her, Sandy, which obviously just devastated the Northeast, and rising sea levels may have contributed to that. So it was a year, I think, finally everybody noticed that we have a problem here, Alicia, and that you can see it. It's part of our everyday lives now.
Yeah, it's so much part of our everyday lives. I mean, on perfectly sunny days, regularly, I walk to get my groceries, and I have to put on rain boots a lot of times. It started to subside.
You live on Miami Beach.
But I live on Miami Beach, and a couple of, I think as recently as last week, there was so much flooding on a perfectly sunny day. I mean, that's the drainage issue that you were talking about, that I have to wear rain boots to walk to the grocery store. But, you know, there's this... there's this balance that I think the sort of local officials and people who are dealing with trying to figure out how to deal with climate change and how to deal with sea level rise have to take into consideration, which is how do you do all this? How do you make really meaningful change, significant change from a scientific perspective, and make sure it's part of the conversation and balance that with not scaring people right. away from this part of the country? I mean, just I know two individuals right now, one who is thinking of buying an apartment on Miami Beach and another who's thinking about selling his apartment on Miami Beach. And they're both sort of like, I think I better maybe unload it because it might be gone in, you know, several decades, or maybe I'm not so smart to buy a place right now.
Although Jane Wooldridge, who was on the show a few weeks ago, said that it, in Venice, which has been you know gradually losing that battle to sea rise for a long time, people hip boots have become a big item for sale or for rent, and that actually it's kind of increased tourism. That there's all that it's just anyway.
Are there Romero Brito hip boots yet?
I'm not sure how that all works, but I'm not sure that would work here. But John, you know, they had this global climate change summit that took place in Doha in Qatar, which happens to be the country that uses up the most per capita carbon dioxide.
That's
right?
A pretty large footprint.
Yeah, large carbon footprint. So they had this, and they said that it threatens everywhere from Miami to the Maldives. And the Maldives are an island chain, which basically they're going to be gone. This is going to be the lost city of Atlantis. I mean, that you wonder if that could be us one day.
Well, let me just start the conversation by talking about your prediction that you made 2 years ago. So I'm looking forward to your prediction for 2014.
He's just going to keep saying sea level rise. That's the trick.
He's going to keep being right.
That's the problem.
But, you know, I think it was ABC that did an interesting report on this. They sent a correspondent up to the North Pole, and she was, you know, talking about really the fact that climate change is real, and she's looking at in fact I think she slept in the shadow of an iceberg, and by the time she got up she was literally almost cut off from well, what is it, from civilization, but she was anyway. but it just pointed out that really there's something happening out there, and there are a number of prominent people are saying that you know, Al Gore among them, of course, saying that we really need to pay attention to this. And, you know, as you know, there are a lot of skeptics as well. So,
but I think the skeptics are fewer and fewer. I mean, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I remember that this was considered sort of a discussion that was on the fringe. You know, it was the fringe people, the hippies, who were worried about climate change. And now I think, you know, for the most part, people believe it's real.
Accepted knowledge. Let's move on to the top international stories of the year. And John has helped us compile these. Let's first take you back to March for comments made by Miami Archbishop Thomas Venski on a papal visit to Cuba that he was a part of.
What we are seeing is a springtime of faith, a reawakening of faith, just as we saw some definite fruits of the visit of the Holy Father 14 years ago. The visit, the presence of the Holy Father in Cuba this week, what he said in Cuba this week, will produce fruit.
The Pope's visit to Cuba in March, John, did it produce any fruit?
Well, the springtime of faith, as the Archbishop talked about, in fact, it was one of our favorite phrases there for a while back in March, it has not really produced the kind of opening that a number of people had expected. I mean, one small thing is that many people had thought that it would lead to the release of Alan Gross. Right. And that's something that hasn't happened. Now it's been 3 years or so that he's been in a Cuban jail trying to get out, and that hasn't happened. Even though we've had a number of people have gone down to see him and talk to him.
But right, this is the American contractor who
was working with the USAID.
USAID,
right. Democracy program.
Cuban authorities thought he was working for the CIA.
Well, no, that's not quite right. Any democracy USAID program is. Right. Forbidden by Cuban law, right?
Exactly. They don't want you to be involved in that. And he's working with USAID.
But at the same time, it's been 3 years now, right. And he has not been released by the Cuban authorities. And it's really kind of sticking in negotiations to move anything forward, because
absolutely,
as long as this
right.
continues to happen, mm-hmm. there's going to be a freeze in relations between the two countries, right? As long as he's still
right.
held there.
Yeah. The U.S. government is saying, look, we have nothing to talk about until you release Alan Gross. And the Cubans are saying, well, let's talk about it. And the Americans are saying, well, we don't want to talk about it. you've got to release the guy. He's being held unfairly. He didn't do the things that you are accusing him of doing. And he's got ailing parents and other family members, and you've got to release this guy. Of course, Cuba is talking about the Cuban Five, among others. So at this point, we are at a standstill, sort of an impasse.
So will, in 2013, with President Obama being reelected, will we see any progress, do you think, unless Alan Gross is released? Any progress in relations?
Well, the one good thing is that Alan Gross's wife is saying that she hopes now with the president's reelection that would lead to some movement. We haven't seen it yet. And in fact, I was talking to someone not too long ago who was saying that they expect, or they think that there will be some kind of movement probably shortly after the inauguration. But from what we've been hearing from Havana, it seems that their tone and neither their words have changed.
Can I ask John a question really quickly? One thing I never understood is I remember there was this optimism that when the Pope visited Cuba that Alan Gross would be released. Like what I guess fueled that hope? What did people think would happen exactly that would lead to his release by the Pope being there?
Well, I think people were thinking going back to when Pope John Paul visited Havana and Fidel Castro had made some concessions around that time. One of them, of course, was I think giving Cubans, I believe, Christmas as a holiday, among other things. Mm-hmm. But there was a feeling that the Pope will not be traveling that far just to go. That there was
maybe
a feeling that there was precisely
made,
had
right.
been because the papal nuncio had several meetings with the government, and there was a feeling that maybe something had been worked out. Sometimes when the Pope visits a country, there are some good vibes that follow that. But in this case, nothing really substantial have happened because of the visit. I mean, it's only been 8-9 months, so a lot of people are waiting to see if something more will come out of it. But so far, the major changes, I mean, there have been some changes as has been happening with in Cuba economically with some of the changes that Raul has been making. But in terms of humanitarian changes, certainly we're still seeing crackdown on dissidents, but that hasn't changed.
All right. Well, let's move on to Venezuela, which obviously is very crucial to Cuba too. We'll take you back to October for elections in Venezuela that had a direct impact on South Florida.
It's been 14 years of repression, 14 years of moving backwards instead of moving forward. I think our country deserves much better.
Even if we are out of the country, we have a chance to do something for our country. We need a change, we need a new people, we need something new, different. Things have to be different now in our country.
We heard there from Venezuelan Americans Felix Pena, Carlini Hernandez, who went all the way from Miami to New Orleans to vote in that country's presidential elections, and then the chance of thousands that made that pilgrimage to the Big Easy, many of them from right here in our neck of the woods. They came away disappointed, though, as Hugo Chavez won another term in their home country. But will he be around to serve out that term? And that remains in doubt with his illness. John, it's still a big question mark.
Well, your guess about that is just about as good as mine. We've been hearing in recent weeks following the surgery that he's had in Cuba that there were some complications, and the latest reports are that he seems to be resting comfortably. But going back to the election, there was a tremendous amount of hope, feeling on the part of Venezuelans here in South Florida. And certainly in Venezuela as well, in terms of the opposition, thinking that they had a real solid chance of unseating Chavez. They came relatively close, as close as they've come in recent elections. I think Capriles lost by 11%. But it didn't happen. Now, they're based on... If you read the tea leaves, I suppose, there are some people saying that he might not be fit enough to take office on January 10th. And if that happens, then the country goes back
to elections. So the opposition is thinking that, you know, there is another opportunity that they will have probably within the not too distant future. So we'll all be seeing if that happens.
Of course, that has a whole geopolitical impact. We talk about Cuba, but the $10 billion in subsidies. I mean, what happens to that country? What happens to the whole balance of the of South America if Chavez is unable to continue as president?
You know, one thing that's interesting, that over the last year, Chavez has been fairly ill. And he's been preoccupied with his health. He hasn't been the Chavez of 2008 or 2009, or certainly not 2010, when he was a little bit more out there making some of the sort of heated comments about the U.S. and elsewhere, and also being very much in your face. So he's been preoccupied, and as a result, we've seen a sort of settling of the region in terms of, in some cases, people have passed him by, in that you look at what Correa is doing in Ecuador. He may be the heir apparent as regionally. You look at Santos in Colombia. He seems to be taking a more leadership role in the region. And also, even you look in Venezuela, Maduro, who may be the one that succeeds Chavez, after, at least Chavez has indicated that's his heir apparent. He has strong ties to Cuba. But whether he's going to be as as strongly leftist and as involved in regional issues with a certain point of view as Chavez, that's to be seen.
All right, now we are coming up, and we only have a couple of moments here. It deserves more, and we'll have more coverage on WLRN about the third year anniversary of the Haiti earthquake and its aftermath. Still, so many things that need to be fixed in that country.
We're going to be running a five-part series starting the week of January 7th, specifically focusing on a dancer who lost her leg in that earthquake and looking at the process of her recovery, which has been complicated.
Yeah, and that's another story, obviously, that hits right home with us here in South Florida with members of the Haitian American diaspora, John.
Oh, absolutely. And there have been, in Haiti, a kind of stability that we've seen this year. You know, in Haiti, it seems like, something that I've said for a long time, Haiti seems to be in perpetual crisis. We didn't see that as much in 2012. Certainly there have been some issues, some dust up here and there, but Haiti was not at the tip of everyone's thumb because there seemed to be some stability there. One of the reasons that came with the appointment of Lamont as the new prime minister. And then we also saw something which is really good news for Haiti to some extent, the opening of that major industrial park in Caracol. Mm-hmm. Although there were some questions about whether or not paying people to stitch fabrics is taking away from paying farmers to till the land and provide food that way. But at least that's one good thing that we've seen in Haiti, some good news there of late.
All right, we're going to wrap things up, and we left a lot of stuff on the table here. I know, Alicia, one little thing you wanted to mention was a departure on the art scene this year.
Yes, Edward Villela, the founder of the Miami City Ballet, 27 years ago, I believe it was, he left the ballet this year under probably less than ideal circumstances. There was some, disagreement with the board, but, he really deserves a nod for creating a cultural institution, maybe one of the first cultural institutions in the state, in Florida, in Miami, certainly, that really drew national attention. And his successor, Lourdes Lopez, is one of the first women, might be actually the first woman, to lead a major ballet company in the country.
And this final note, the agony and the ecstasy, at least of local sports, the Heat win the NBA Finals. The Marlins dismantle their franchise after moving into a new ballpark. Kevin from Miami on the Public Insight Network writes, the most significant event actually relates to the scandal of the Marlins ballpark funding, something we've talked a lot about. And even more scandalously, Kenny, we don't have time to play all the cuts from your story, but how much you'll pay for a beer?
That's correct. Breaking news, beer is very expensive at Marlins Park. $8 for the small draft domestic beer.
Which is also, coincidentally, the same amount as the Marlins payroll for 2013.
Oh. and the same talent level, I've heard.
Well, that'll do it for this program. It's been fun, guys, as we review the year. Alicia Zuckerman, our arts and enterprise editor, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Phil.
John Yearwood, world editor for the Miami Herald, coming here on his vacation to join us today. Thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure, Phil. Anything for you.
And Kenny Malone is a feature reporter for WLR and Miami Herald News. Another year of great work for you, sir. Thank you.
At Radio Malone, follow me.
And I'm at Phil Latzman. You got John Yearwood.
At Alicia Zuckerman.
All right. We got our Twitter handles in there. Thanks to Peter J. Meritz, our executive producer and technical supervisor today. Alicia produces the program. Elaine Chan, our associate producer. Thank you to them. For WLR and Miami Herald News, Dan Gretsch. Our technical supervisor, Paul Leary, South Florida Arts Beat is next. Until next week and next year, Happy New Year. I'm Phil Latzman, and don't forget, in 2013, stay informed, South Florida.